You're listening to WKXL in the Morning. I'm your host, AJ Kerstad. Let's get the latest in New Hampshire government news with our friends in New Hampshire Bulletin. Get their articles at newhampshirebulletin.com. They join WKXL in the Morning every Friday. I'm joined by reporter Amanda Gokey today. Welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
All right, we got to hit the elephant in the room when it comes to political news this past week, which is the Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College was hosting the Executive Council, and there was a problem.
Yeah, that's right. So they were met with a pretty raucous crowd of protesters at the meeting yesterday who were anti-vaccine, and there was a $27 million contract for the vaccine that was due to be discussed. And they started chanting to shut down the meeting. I spoke with the director of the Institute, and he mentioned that he started receiving personal threats against him even an hour before the meeting had started. So things got out of hand there. Governor Chris Sununu didn't ever make it out of the back room, and they ended up canceling that meeting and a couple of subsequent meetings as well. So the fiscal committee was scheduled to meet on Friday. That got canceled, although they did say, a spokesperson did say, that it was not due to safety concerns, but that they wanted more information on one of the contracts that they were going to be discussing. And the Institute of Politics actually decided that they wouldn't be hosting any future events with the legislature because of safety concerns.
This is a very confusing movement to me with these anti-vaccine protesters, because I don't know if they're trying to nip it in the bud or what, but this literally is just a proposal to assist the state to get vaccines to communities that want to get it. There's no mandate involved with it. I spoke last week to Professor Lucy Hodder on the Legal Impact podcast, and she was blown away that there was so much dissent against this funding that the state's trying to get, because there's literally no vaccine mandate in any of it. Any mandate that is being trying to push through with the OSHA, through OSHA, which President Biden is trying to do, also has a rider saying that if you don't get the vaccine, you just got to get tested every week. So it's very odd.
Yeah, and one of the things that came up when I was speaking with the executive director of the Institute of Politics was he didn't even classify the people who were at the meeting as protesters, because for him it felt very anti-democratic, and that it was more about disruption and chaos and confusion than it was about protesting in the sense of participating in a conversation, in a democratic conversation. So I thought that was an interesting and important distinction that he was drawing from.
Yeah, traditionally, I mean, especially you're talking the last handful of years, I mean, I'm assuming a lot of these people are right wing, probably vote Republican for the most part. And they were the ones that were shouting every 2 seconds about Antifa and such during the early Trump years and through that. And now they're kind of using some of the same tactics to stop the Executive Council from doing business.
Yeah, and there's an interesting dynamic where the Republican leadership has acted surprised, as in, like, we're your people, we're here to represent you. And yet they're not. I mean, we saw it in front of the State House at the similarly anti-vax kind of event that was held there, where they sort of, the protesters turned on the Republican leadership. So I think there's definitely a tension between what's going on in the State House and outside of it.
You know, long term, this is likely going to cause problems, if not this November, next year November, because they're specifically going after the party they would likely vote for. So I don't know what that's going to mean when it comes to candidates that might be coming through. So it'll be very interesting here in the next month or two, and then in another year. So what's the deal with the executive committee at this point? I mean, what's their plan to kind of progress? Are they just going to be going back to their chambers?
Anne Marie Timmons, my colleague, is the one who really follows the executive council very closely. From what I know, I haven't actually heard what their plan will be moving forward, nor is it really clear what canceling this meeting and postponing until 2 weeks from now will accomplish. It's clearly a delay in terms of when these contracts will be up for a vote. But I'm not sure what plans are in place to address this differently next time around, or what protocols will change to make sure that this doesn't just happen again.
And there's a deadline on those funds too from the government for the vaccine support within the state. So I think it's like the end, sometime late October. So they got to make a decision really soon. All right. So next up, you recently wrote an article on an island in New Hampshire that's doing something unique when it comes to renewable energy. What was that about?
Yes. So this island, it's called Appledore Island. It's actually technically a part of Maine, of Kittery, Maine. So it's off the coast of New Hampshire, just about 6 or 7 miles. But there's a lab, a marine biology lab there run by UNH and Cornell University. And so back in the day, they started, the island isn't connected to our main electrical grid. It has to operate, it has to be completely self-sufficient in terms of their energy. So initially they were bringing in a lot of diesel to fuel their generator. But that was really expensive. And so they sort of started this initiative of switching over to renewable sources of energy, solar panels, and a wind turbine as a way of saving money. Over a period of years, they've decreased their reliance on this diesel generator by 90%.
Wow.
Which is a huge figure. But what was interesting to learn is actually half of that was through conserving energy. So just using less energy, and the other half, or the other remaining percentage, it would be slightly less than a half, was through bringing on these other sources of energy, wind and solar energy to meet their needs.
What's unique about the way they're doing compared to other places?
Well, I think what's interesting about this is it's a micro grid. So there you have kind of a contained environment where you can see exactly the input and the output. So you can see on a really small scale how the energy that's being generated is limited. When we turn on a light switch on the mainland, we don't think about, okay, is a coal plant firing up right now so that I can turn on my light? There's kind of an idea that energy is unlimited, and that really breaks down in an island context. The other thing that is unique about the island is it's such a high percentage of renewables that they're using. And that's kind of a good laboratory setting for some of the goals that may be easier to toss around politically, to say we want to reach 100% renewable or 100% clean energy by such and such date. But this island is an opportunity to look at what that actually entails in practice. One of the interesting takeaways for me was some research off the island that actually the amount of batteries they would have to add to their system to reach 100% with how much usage they currently have was huge. And the director of the lab told me that it was actually cost prohibitive, and that she would adjust the goals of the island. Other ideas were maybe you can make up that percentage through conserving energy. So don't use as much energy and lower your use that way, because those sort of last percentage points are accounting for situations that are really rare, a week when the wind isn't blowing or the sun isn't shining, but your usage is still high.
Yeah, that's the thing with renewable energy. Those are basically the two hiccups when it comes to renewable energy, is battery technology hasn't really progressed in the last 20 years. I mean, lithium ion batteries, which you get in your laptops and phones and such, and you see them in Teslas and Priuses, that was like the biggest leap in battery technology, and nothing much has really happened from there. So that's really going to be a huge stepping stone for the general public to really have access to renewable energy independently off the grid, because what's unique about this island is they do have these multiple ways of collecting electricity, the wind, water. I can't do that in my apartment. And that, to be able to diversify, is going to be very important.
Right. And this is kind of an interesting challenge with what are called intermittent resources, where they're not going all the time and you can't call on it. Like, you can't just, it's not like building a fire and you're burning a fuel that, you know, is, I can turn to that, depend on it, and use it at this set time. But actually, you mentioned water, and that's another really interesting part of the equation that they're looking at on the island, is water is another finite resource, potable water, drinking water. So they'll use that. There's times of the day where it is windy and it is sunny, so you have this excess energy. And once you've filled up the batteries, you can use that to desalinate water and make what would be salty, undrinkable water into drinking water. And that's something some of the engineers I spoke with said, that's a design question that towns and cities and municipalities can be looking at as well, is kind of matching times of day where there's a lot of energy coming onto the grid with these really high energy intensive processes like pumping water and moving it around, which again, aren't things that we think about necessarily in our day-to-day life.
Yeah, the university must love having this place to kind of see the numbers and such. I mean, what are some big lessons that they've learned over their time of developing the different options? I mean, is it primarily the importance of diversification?
I think that the big takeaway that came up in my interviews had to do with conservation of energy and the awareness that they brought to each decision that they were making. For example, the director of the lab was telling me when they go to bring on a new piece of scientific equipment for their research, they will immediately calculate its energy usage into their overall understanding of how much energy they're using. And that's one of the activities that they'll have the students who come to the island do, is to just kind of take readings of how much energy this is using, how much energy that is using. And it's something, their point was, it's something we really are disconnected from and don't necessarily have a good sense on the mainland in our own homes or in our day-to-day lives. Like, what is it that's using the most energy?
And it's great that the university, I mean, especially if there's any engineers in that crew, I mean, the fact that they get that training early to consider that, because I'd imagine a lot of places don't, that's not even part of the equation. I go, I need to build this, let's just make it, and we have unlimited power if we plug it in. Obviously, they got to work off of what is accessible inside of a house currently, but long term, that is going to be something as we switch to more and more renewable energy sources.
And that was something that I came across as well, is, you know, one of New Hampshire's utilities, Unitil, is sponsoring this internship program on the island. In part, that's because the engineers who go there for training get to look at this small contained example of a lot of the problems that they will have to face and figure out on the mainland. So there is this kind of direct translation, even though the environments do seem very different, but from an engineering standpoint, there's a lot of crossover between the two.
So this week you've been working a bit on redistricting in New Hampshire, which has been a long time thing in the state. When, if you look at the districts and the big dragon shape that goes across the center of the state, I've spoken to Professor John Graby about that a bit, but what's going on with that now?
Yeah, so there was a working session today in the House Special Redistricting Committee. They've been also hosting a series of listening sessions around the state. That was actually one of the events that was canceled. There was supposed to be a redistricting listening session tomorrow at the Institute of Politics. That was canceled out of the Executive Council fiasco. So essentially, these listening sessions are happening. The members of both the House and the Senate are listening to input from the communities at this stage, and determining how to implement that, that feedback that they've been receiving. One of the issues that came up in a few of the listening sessions, I think in all of them so far it's come up, is that New Hampshire obviously is a unique state in, to some extent, in how many representatives, state representatives there are, with 400 spread across the state. And the latest census data, that means there's about 3,000 for one rep per 3,444 people, which raises some interesting issues for these lawmakers as they're trying to draw the maps. But one of the things that people have really been driving home is that according to New Hampshire's constitution, a town or a district or a city ward, rather, that has that number of residents is supposed to constitutionally have their own representative. But when these maps were drawn back in 2010, a huge number of towns, 62 towns out of 152 that were supposed to have their own representative, didn't get one for one reason or another. So a lot of people have been saying this actually creates some big problems for their towns in terms of having a voice in state government and someone who can just represent the needs of their community. So what you have is towns that kind of get grouped together with other towns that don't necessarily share the same issues, or their school districts are set up very differently. So for those towns, it's especially problematic.
How did it end up that so many towns ended up that way? Was it a matter of inefficiencies in the system? Was it a matter of partisan gerrymandering, or do we not really know?
So there's different cases. It can look a little bit different depending on which place that you go. I think the, a lot of, one of the answers is just that the math is very complicated. So there are certain instances.
That's not very many people per rep. That's a lot of representatives for a little New Hampshire.
Yeah. Well, so a lot of places they're in this sort of situation where they have to, there's cases where the violation of the constitution is necessary. There's kind of no way around it. And it's because there's a lot of requirements that go into the process. There's a lot of sort of boxes that these people drawing the maps have to check. But there are also some cases where, and examples that I've heard of where it is sort of partisan influence. So one example is the town of Pelham and Hudson. So they're grouped together as one district currently. Pelham is a purple town, Hudson is a red town, and if you combine those two, it makes Pelham a red town. So there's examples that you can point to like that where it seems clear that there's some sort of partisan influence that's shaping the process. But it's not clear in all cases. And regardless of, even it, I think in a situation where there were where there was no partisan sort of playing with this, it would be impossible to get that number of constitutional violations down to zero.
What are the next steps for this?
So the listening sessions are still continuing at this point. They've all been scheduled except for two, and the House has a deadline to draw their maps and submit them by November 18th. People have been really adamant about wanting to have a second round of listening sessions before that date because they want to review maps after they've been drawn. But no details have been published about that yet. And so we're still waiting to hear when that second round of meetings may take place.
Well, we'll have you back on to talk about that, that's for sure. Thanks so much for joining me, Amanda Gokey, the New Hampshire Bulletin. Check out newhampshirebulletin.com. You listen to WKXL in the morning.